The key, when she found it, was equally massive, as thick as her middle finger, and the hatch so heavy that it took all of her strength to drag it aside. Then she had to double over to get through the low opening. Behind her, Mungo St. John heard the scrape of wood on wood and dropped silently down the steps to the door of the lazaretto. With a cocked pistol in one hand, he laid his ear to the oak planking to listen for a moment before trying the handle. "God's breath," he muttered angrily as he found it locked, and then turned away and raced on bare feet up the companionway to the cabin of his first mate. At the first touch on his thickly muscled shoulder, Tipu was fully awake, his eyes glistening in the gloom like those of a wild animal. "Someone has broken into the hold," St. John hissed at him, and Tipu reared up on his bunk, a huge dark figure. "We find him," he grunted, as he bound the loincloth around his waist. "Then we feed fish with him." The main hold seemed vast as a cathedral. The beam of the lantern could not reach into its deepest recesses, and a great mass of cargo was piled high, in some places as high as the main deck, 15 feet above her. She saw at once that the cargo had been loaded in such a way that it could be unloaded piecemeal, that any single item could be identified and swung up through the hatches without the necessity of unloading the whole. This, of course, must be essential in a ship trading from port to port. She saw also that the goods were carefully packaged and clearly labelled. Flashing the lantern around her, she saw that the cases of equipment for their own expedition were packed here. Ballantine Africa expedition, stenciled in black on the raw white wood. She clambered up the rampart of cases and bales and balanced on the peak, turning the lantern upwards towards the square opening of the hatch, trying to see if there was an open grating. And immediately she was frustrated, for the white canvas cover had been stretched around the lower surface also. She stood at full stretch to try and touch the hatch, to feel for the shape of a grating under the canvas, but her fingertips were inches short of the hatch, and a sudden wild plunge of the ship under her sent her flying backwards into the deep aisle between the piles of cargo. She managed to keep her grip on the lantern, but hot oil from its reservoir splashed over her hand, threatening to blister the skin. Once again she crawled up and over the mountains of cargo, searching for the evidence that she hoped not to find. There was no dividing bulkhead in the hold, but the mainmast pierced the deck above and came through the hold to rest its foot on the keel. And there were step wedges fixed to the thick column of Norwegian pine. "Perhaps they were there to hold the slave decks." Robin knelt beside the mast and sighted across the hold to the outward curved side of the ship. In line with the wedges on the mast were heavy wooden ledges, like shallow shelves, and she thought that these might be supports for the outer edges of the slave decks. She guessed that they were between 2.5 and 3 feet apart, which she had read was the average height of the between decks in a slaver. She tried to imagine what this hold might look like with those decks in place, tiers of low galleries just high enough for a man to crawl into, doubled over. She counted the shelves, and there were 5 of them. 5 piles of decks, each with its layer of naked black humanity, laid out sardine fashion, each one in physical contact with his neighbour on either side, lying there in his own filth and that of the slaves above him, which leaked through the seams of the deck. She tried to imagine the heat of the middle passage, when the ship lay becalmed in the baking doldrums. She tried to imagine 2,000 of them vomiting and purging with seasickness, as the ship reared and plunged in the wild seas where the Mozambique current scoured the Orgullis bank. She tried to imagine an epidemic of cholera or smallpox taking hold of that mass of misery. But her imagination could not rise to the task, and she pushed the hideous images aside and crawled on over the heaving cargo, flashing her lantern into each corner, searching for more solid evidence than the narrow ledges. If there were planking on board, it would be laid flat upon the deck, below this cargo, and there was no way in which Robin could reach it. Ahead of her, she saw a dozen huge casks bolted to the forward bulkhead. They could be water barrels, or they could be filled with trade rum, or the rum could be replaced with water when the slaves were taken on board. There was no means of checking the contents, but she knocked on the oak with the hilt of her scalpel, and the dull tone assured her that the casks contained something. She squatted down on one of the bales and slit the stitching with a scalpel. Thrusting her hand into the opening, she grasped a handful and pulled it out to examine it in the lamplight. Trade beads. Ropes of them strung on cotton threads. A bickle of beads was as long as the interval between fingertip and wrist. Four bickle made a kete. These beads were made of scarlet porcelain. They were the most valued variety, called samsam. An African of the more primitive tribes would sell his sister for a kete of these, his brother for two kete. Robin crawled on, examining crates and bales, bolts of cotton cloth from the mills of Salem, called Makani in Africa, a corruption of the word American, and the checkered cloth from Manchester known as Kaniki. Then there were long wooden crates marked simply 5 pieces, and she could guess that they contained muskets. However, firearms were common trade goods to the coast, and no proof of the intention to buy slaves. They could just as readily be used to purchase ivory or gum copal. She was tired now with the effort of climbing and blundering around over the heaving slopes and peaks of cargo, and with the nervous tension of the search. She paused to rest a moment, leaning back against one of the bales of Makani cloth, and as she did so, something dug painfully into her back, forcing her to change her position. Then she realized that cloth should not have hard lumps in it. She shuffled around and once again slit the sacking cover of the bale. Protruding from between the folded layers of cloth, there was something black and cold to the touch. She pulled it out, and it was heavy iron, looped and linked, and she recognized it instantly. In Africa they were called the bracelets of death. Here at last was proof, positive and irrefutable, for these steel slave cuffs, with the light marching chains, were the unmistakable stigmata of the slave trade. Robin tore the bale wider open. There were hundreds of the iron cuffs concealed between layers of cloth. Even had it been possible, a perfunctory search by a naval boarding party was highly unlikely to have uncovered this sinister hoard. She selected one set of cuffs with which to confront her brother, and she started aft towards the lazaretto, filled suddenly with desire to be out of this dark cavern with its menacing shadows, and back once more in the safety of her own cabin. She had almost reached the entrance to the lazaretto when suddenly there was a loud scraping sound from the deck above, and she froze with alarm. When the sound was repeated, she had enough of her wits still about her to douse the snuffer of her lantern, and then immediately regretted having done so, for the darkness seemed to crush down upon her with a suffocating weight, and she felt panic rising up to take possession of her. With a crash like a cannon shot, the main hatch flew open, and as she swung back towards it, she saw the white pinpricks of the stars outlined by the square opening. Then a huge dark shape dropped through, landing lightly on the piled bales beneath, and at almost the same instant the hatch thudded closed again, blotting out the starlight. Now Robin's terror came bubbling to the surface. There was somebody locked in the hold with her, and the knowledge held her riveted for long, precious seconds before she plunged back towards the lazaretto hatch, suppressing the scream that choked up into her throat. The shape she had glimpsed for a moment was unmistakable. She knew that it was Tipu in the hold with her, and it spurred her terror. She could imagine the great, hairless, toad-like figure moving towards her in the darkness with repulsive reptilian swiftness, could almost see the pink tongue flickering out over thick, cruel lips. And her haste became uncontrolled. She lost her footing in the darkness and fell heavily, tumbling backwards into one of the deep gullies between banks of cargo, cracking the back of her skull on a wooden case, half stunning herself so that she lost her grip on the extinguished lantern and could not find it when she groped for it. When she scrambled to her knees again, she had lost all sense of direction in the total blackness of the hold. She knew that her best defence was to remain silent and still, until she could place the man who was hunting her, and she crouched down in a crack between two crates. Her pulse beat in her ears like a drum, deafening her, and her heart seemed to have crammed up into her throat so that she must fight for each breath. It took many minutes and all her determination to bring herself under control to be able to think again. She tried to decide in which direction lay the lazaretto hatch, her only means of escape. But she knew that the only way she would be able to find it would be to grope her way to the ship's wooden side and follow it around. The prospect of doing this, with that grotesque creature hunting her in the darkness, was appalling. She shrank down as far as she could into the narrow space and listened. The hold was filled with small sounds that she had not noticed before. The heave and creak of the ship's timbers, the shifts of the cargo against its retaining ropes and netting. But then she heard the movement of a living thing close behind her, and she caught the shriek of terror before it reached her lips, as she lifted her arm to protect her head. Frozen like that, she waited for a blow which never came. Instead, she heard another movement pass behind her, turned shoulder, a whisper of sound, yet so chilling that she felt all power of movement drain from her legs. He was here, very close in the blackness, toying with her, cruel as a cat. He had smelt her out. With some sort of animal sense, Tipu had found her unerringly in the darkness, and now he crouched over her, ready to strike, and she could only wait. Something touched her shoulder, and before she could jerk away, it swarmed up over her neck, brushed her face. She flung herself backwards and screamed, striking out wildly with the steel chain and handcuffs, which she still held in her right hand. The thing was furry and quick, and it squealed sharply like an angry piglet as she struck again and again. Then it was gone, and she heard the scamper of small feet across the rough wood of the crate, and she realized that it was one of the ship's rats, big as a tomcat. Robin shuddered, revolted, but with a lift of relief that was short-lived. There was a flash of light, so unexpected that it almost blinded her, and a lantern beam was thrown in a single swift sweep about the hold and then extinguished, so that the darkness seemed even more crushing than before. The hunter had heard her scream, and had flashed his lantern in her direction, and probably seen her, for she had clambered out of her niche between the crates. Now at least she knew in which direction to move. The brief flash of light had orientated her once again. She knew where to find the hatch. She threw herself over a pile of soft bales, clawing herself towards the hatch, then checking her flight to think a moment. Tipu must have known how she had entered the hold, and would know that she would try to escape in the same direction. She must move with care, with stealth, ready for the moment when he flashed the lantern again, taking care not to rush headlong into the trap he was certainly setting for her. She changed her grip on the iron chain, only then realizing its potential as a weapon, much more effective than the short-bladed scalpel in her pocket. A weapon! For the first time she was thinking of defending herself, not merely crouching like a chicken before the stoop of the hawk. Robbie was always the plucky one. She could almost hear her mother's voice, troubled but touched with pride, when she had defended herself effectively against the village ruffians, or joined her brother on some of his more hair-raising escapades. And she realized she needed all of that pluck now. With the chain gripped in her right hand, she started stealthily back towards the hatch, crawling, slithering forward on her belly, pausing to listen every few seconds. It seemed like a complete round of eternity before her outstretched fingers touched the solid planking of the after bulkhead. She was within feet of the hatch now, and that was where he would be waiting for her. She crouched down, with her back firmly against the planking, and waited for the flutter of her heart to abate enough to allow her to hear. But any noise her hunter made was covered by the creak and pop and groan of the working wooden hull, and the thud and hiss of the sea as Huron beat up hard to the wind. Then she wrinkled her nose at a new smell that overlaid the pervading reek of the bilges. It was the hot oil smell of a shuttered lantern burning very close by. And now, when she listened for it, she thought she could hear the pinkle and tick of the heated metal of the lantern. He must be very close, very close, guarding the hatchway, ready to flash the lantern at the moment he could place her whereabouts accurately.